which one are we doing first? Drones. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. This, I usually say fine morning. I'm not sure this is a fine morning. It's going to be an interesting travel day for some, so be safe while you're out there. This Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. We have a couple of exciting presentations today. I'm delighted to have people in the room to talk about some very innovative things, and then we have a study on freight movement, so we're looking forward to that. But we're going to open with an informational meeting on the drone industry status report, and I hear this is a wonderful presentation, so I'm very much looking forward to it. Patrick, do I need to formally open an informational hearing?
I think you've just done it, Madam
Are
Chair.
We good? Yeah, we don't need to gavel in?
Well, you, the gavel never hurts.
Okay.
I mean, you got one.
That's right. The gavel never hurts.
Then I will open an informational hearing.
It's an implied gavel if you don't get
on drone industry. Gentlemen, your reputations precede you. That this is quite fascinating. So welcome, and please proceed in any order that you choose.
Okay, pressure's on. Chair McEwen, representatives of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Swecker. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation, and we're here to talk about the drone industry and a little bit about state regulation. And I'll dive right into it and just talk a little bit about our panelists here. Brian Whiteside is a very knowledgeable representative, past president of AUVSI Cascades, one of the most active chapters, and Steve Christman, who's the airport manager at Pendleton. And I'd also like to point out that they recently restarted commercial air service out there with Boutique Airlines, and Steve had a great deal to do with that after Seaport went bankrupt, and we'll talk a little bit about the range out in
that impacted
in
my local airport as well. So I'm glad you're up and operating. That's
Thank
great.
Thank you. Yes, we are too.
So I'm going to start with kind of a higher level here. The FAA looks at drones and the unmanned aircraft systems in kind of some very basic ways, and I'll just talk about this. You can almost always categorize everything into public use, meaning that it's owned and operated by public entities, for example, a university or a state agency or a federal agency or something like that. Private use commercial, which is now considered what they call Part 107. And then private recreational, which is the ones that you get under the Christmas tree and the ones that the FAA has a great deal of concern about. And most likely the most challenging to regulate, because the commercial industry is regulated by having to have insurance and very, very tightly regulated by the FAA, and public use the same way. And then you break it down into three weight categories, and over 55 pounds they consider heavy. Under 55 pounds is light, and that comes under the Part 107 and any of the recreational ones. And then it says here 4.44 pounds for a micro category. It's actually been reduced to 0.55 pounds, and there's some evaluation of those based on the kinetic energy, whether it has potential to hurt you or not. And they'll be most likely able to fly over crowds because the potential for hurting somebody is a little bit less. So that's in rulemaking right now. And then there are three really main issues that you can slot virtually everything into. The privacy issue, protection of the privacy of property owners and citizens, and then law enforcement and making sure that we take care of the due process and having to have a warrant. And we'll talk a little bit about back in 2013, ACLU went around the country and got many states to introduce legislation, including here in Oregon. We'll talk about that just a little bit. And then last one is safety. You've all heard about the drone that flies close to an aircraft on short final into a major airport. Okay. This all started with the FAA back in 2012, the Modernization Reform Act of 2012, where the Congress directed the FAA to incorporate them into the national airspace. And they took a very slow approach up until about a year ago. And what this slide will show you is that a lot's happened in the past year. The first thing is last Christmas, they decided that there was so many of them being introduced to the citizenry that they actually required them to start registering. They made it very easy, $5 charge, and it's anything between the 0.55 pounds that I talked about, 55 pounds. And there's over 300,000 registered now, which is more than manned aircraft registrations with the FAA.
So how is the registration done? Is it at point of sale? Is it done by the user online? And how is it determined whether they register or not?
Chair McEwen, it's done online. They have a registration website. They put together an aviation kind of rulemaking committee or recommendation committee, and they convened, and in a very short time, I think between November and December, came up with all the rulemaking with members from industry and other stakeholder groups, and they did this in a relatively short period of time, within about a month.
What's the penalty for not registering?
There isn't a penalty
voluntary.
That I'm aware of.
Correct. It's voluntary. Okay.
Correct. And I would suspect that they're not hitting everybody, but they got enough so that in 1 year there's over 300,000 of which exceeded the manned aircraft numbers. And then they also expanded that, not just from recreational, but also commercial and public use now have to register. Everybody that flies one legitimately in the United States has to register their unmanned aircraft system. And you may recall from 2013, the legislature required us to register any public use unmanned aircraft systems, which we've done. We have about 74 registrations total. And there's a couple other changes to it. The COA is a certificate of authorization. They made it blanket so that they could fly up to 400 feet. Before it was specific case by case. Now it's a blanket change. And then the micro UAS rulemaking, which is in progress right now. And the final thing is it used to be by exception that they allowed any commercial operations in the National Airspace System. Under Part 107, it's a lot less restrictive in terms of it's not case by case now. If you actually have a commercial operation and you meet certain requirements, you now are able to fly. There's still an exception policy based on that 2012 law, Part 333 of it, which is why it's named that. Mm-hmm. And so that's the most recent change. In Oregon, back in 2013, House Bill 2710 was one of the more comprehensive bills passed around the U.S. Alaska and North Carolina were comparable back then, but we did a fairly good job, I think, in doing state regulation. We had one issue that was preemptible. That was an altitude restriction back at that time. The FAA had a requirement if you flew higher than 400 feet, then you were exceeding their limitation, their regulation. We passed a law here under 2710 that said if you flew lower than 400 feet, that you were subject to civil penalties if a private property owner objected to it. So that was fixed in 2015. Deleted the 400-foot altitude, really made it based on the intent of the operator. And then in 2015, legislature passed the law saying no angling or fishing using an unmanned aircraft system and prohibiting people from harassing anglers and fishermen. And in 2016, House Bill 4066, it really clarified the privacy and due process, made some tweaks to the 2710 bill, and then expanded the no weaponization process. It was applicable only to law enforcement prior to that, made it applicable to everybody. And it also put in place a critical infrastructure protection over certain things like power plants and refineries and that sort of thing. And then we have a stakeholders work group that meets on a fairly regular basis that includes ACLU, the industry, some legislative staffs.
Representative McLean has a question.
I don't want to wreck your flow, but the one thing I don't remember is that the portion there on 2015 House Bill 2354, can you explain a little bit more about what took the place of the deletes the 400 feet? You know, I don't understand. I can't remember that part.
With the FAA, because it was contradictory to federal law, they just took out the 400-foot restriction. And it became more based on the intention of the operator. There was nothing that specifically replaced it in terms of altitude up until the 4066 critical infrastructure bill, that added a 400-foot restriction back in for protection of the critical infrastructure. So the stakeholder work group meets on a regular basis, most recently this past Monday, and they looked and reviewed a couple of legislative concepts that are not fully fleshed out yet. I don't have copies of them because they're still being worked on, or I've seen the copies of them, but I'm sure that they need a little bit of tweaking before they come back again. But they deal with law enforcement, privacy, commercial use specific to agricultural, and obviously safety issues as well. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I have before I turn it over to my colleagues is this is a fact sheet that was put out by the FAA at the national level, and it was kind of a shot across the bow to the states on the whole preemption issue, where they're concerned about a patchwork quilt of laws that might occur in the states regulating airspace, establishing things like the 400-foot altitude restriction, that they say that that's their territory, the federal government, and that by having this patchwork of quilt, it's not efficient, it's not a good way to go, and this is the language from that. And then there's also state preemption. In the House Bill 2710, I think very wisely, the legislature said that nobody inside the state except the legislature could regulate unmanned aircraft systems. And subject to any questions, I'll pass it on to my colleagues.
Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Brian Whiteside, and I am one of the new appointees to the City Aviation Board. So I serve with Mitch on that, and then I am also a local business owner, and one of the people who are living the dream with pioneering these unique technologies. I serve on various national committees as well. I serve on the Helicopter Safety Advisory Committee, working on airspace issues and safety issues with manned aircraft. I'm part of the Helicopter Association International UAS Committee, working on sort of the federal issues and trying to figure out how to incorporate and bring in sort of the manned aviation flavors to this. I'm a pilot myself, and then also work in the unmanned space. What I've got here, a couple of photos just on the slide. These are actually from our operations and the work that we do, and I think it's really important for people sort of to visualize what these drones do. And so if you look at the images up there on the left, that's a bowhead whale. That's work that we did this summer with World Wildlife Fund up in the Arctic. We're doing research up there on the bowhead whales and some of the environmental impacts up there. You can see a cell phone tower inspection that we've done. There's a turbine that caught on fire that was more of an insurance claim, and see if we could determine what was the cause of the fire on that wind turbine. And then on the right, that's an offshore production platform, and we do offshore work on corrosion detection, flare stacks, things like that.
Sir, were you able to determine the cause of the fire?
No, that's up to the insurance company. But it looks like the cause, they think, started with batteries in the back.
Okay.
That's kind of what we did, but, you know, we were more than just the collection.
The whale, what's the range of the drone? How close do you have to get to that whale to launch a drone to go?
You know, the technology is amazing because every day we're getting, it's a computer, so we get better capabilities and we can have better standoff. But for the majority of this work, we were about 75 feet from the animal itself.
Okay.
All of this is done under permitting this was up in Canada. So through the Canadian Department, basically their Fish and Wildlife, we get the permits to go out and to study the animals. And
it's done off a vessel.
Yes, it's off of a boat, and these are basically small multi-rotor drones that are commercially available. I mean, and it's amazing that the systems that we use range from a price that starts at about $150,000 a unit down to ones that actually did the whale work that were about $1,100 a unit.
Amazing.
So quite a range in capability and technology.
Amazing. Thank you.
So next slide. So here in Oregon, this comes, I put on my AUVSI hat, which is the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International. We're the trade association, and I'm basically the outgoing chapter president. But in Oregon, we have a unique position in that we really are a national leader and have a cluster of this industry that is growing up here in Oregon, whether it's, you know, in Hood River and all of the technology that's coming out of Hood River and in situ and the spinoff companies that are supporting that industry with Boeing, et cetera. We've got the test ranges that you're going to hear about a little bit and sort of that infrastructure that is just getting up and going, and it's really exciting. And then we've got all the new companies that are in Portland. And it's really important to understand that when we talk about drones, it's a broad spectrum of technologies, and it it applies. Somebody who's working with maybe unmanned aircraft today may be working with unmanned ground vehicles tomorrow. And the industries are really blended. So when you start to impact one, you can in fact impact a whole level of sub companies that are just starting, you know, here in Oregon. And if you think about what's happening in Portland on the vehicles as well, we've got, you know, Mercedes, Jaguar, the trucking industry, and they're all sort of blending this world in cross domains, whether it flies or drives. They're sort of similar in the industry that's growing here. And Oregon has become this cluster of these companies and technologies, and it's really exciting to be a part of what's really happening here in Oregon, and it's unique here. So it's really important to understand that. And then we've got sort of what's going on the research side as well. So Oregon is really growing, and it's just starting to take hold, and it's really important to kind of keep that nurturing mindset going. Next slide. You know, the industry as well is just starting. I know everybody assumes that this technology has been around for a long time, and we've been working with the FAA, and it seems like it just takes forever to get up and going. But Part 107 is basically, think of it as the pivot point for the industry. That is 4 months old. You know, those rules were passed in August. And if you look at the forecast, this is from Goldman Sachs report. Between now and 2020, we're going from where we are today, which is 4 months old, to an industry that's going to be $20 billion a year on the commercial side here in the U.S. That's 3 years. That's a huge growth, and if we miss this opportunity now, it's going to pass Oregon by. So it's really important that we're supportive and that we think of it in the terms of where we're going and what the foundation is right now and how rapidly that's going to evolve, because once the foundation's set, it's going to be very hard to bring back, and we're really in a good spot right now. Next slide.
What do you see as the risks? I mean, what's out there that could stop us?
Fortunately, you know, with Mitch and I think all the state activity and interest in what we're doing, you've built a very good culture. If we were to pass legislation right now, that were to sort of step on the toes of what's being developed, we could very quickly change that perception of what's been built here. And we're seeing the draw of sort of that nurturing nature that we're open to this business, we're encouraging people to come, and the benefits that's bringing. But that could change very quickly, and it's still very fragile. So we want to make sure that we don't do something that would affect sort of that perception in a way that could prevent us from taking advantage of sort of that infrastructure that's just being built right now.
And I guess my question then again is there something out there that you see that you are perceiving as a threat?
Not currently, but that's why we're here.
Okay. So your advice is stay out of the way.
Yeah, stay out of the way and just keep doing what you're doing. Ask questions, be involved, understand where we're going. Happy to have rudder. You know, if there's things that you feel are important that need to be addressed, that's really good. But we know that those issues that Mitch, you know, brought up earlier are very important. Safety, the privacy, and then the public use. You know, these are really important, and we want to be a part of sort of making good laws. But, you know, the 400-foot is a great example of good intentions, but I think misapplied. So we want to just make sure that we're sort of keeping that going. And
we will look to you for guidance.
Absolutely. Happy to help.
Manager.
And so, if you know, again.
Representative McLean.
Well, you guys started a really interesting little conversation there. So can we stop for just a minute?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, get out of the way is, you know, I understand that. Especially when industry is really trying to figure out themselves where they are, where they want to go, and what the potential is. But as you pointed out in those first three areas, you know, whether it be safety or privacy or anything else as far as public use and private use and commercial use, there are questions to be had anytime we have a new industry.
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, Uber is, you know, an example of, I think they made $30 billion in 5 years, so you guys are going to have to go a little bit to get there. But it's a situation where I think that the questions, we want to be out of the way. We want to be supportive. We want to make sure the industry has an opportunity to grow and to develop in a way that's practical and, you know, productive for everyone. So I guess what I'm saying is I hope that in this dialogue that you're going to continue to have here in this presentation even, that you're giving us some guidance on, as the chair said, what are those potential risks out there, both for the public and for the industry.
Right.
Because, you know, we're going to look for those same things as where can we be supportive of industry, but where do we need to be protective of our own citizenry? And so I want to see the big picture here. Because, like you said, it's all, you know, cutting edge.
Absolutely.
Director Twicker.
Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, one of the things that the stakeholders work group that I mentioned does, it includes ACLU, it includes the industry, it's largely sponsored by Judiciary Committee, Channa Newell, and also Representative Huffman.
Okay.
So I think that group is trying to make sure that it hits all of the stakeholders and make sure that we do this right at the state level. So I think that's one way that we're addressing your concerns, or that stakeholder group is addressing your concerns.
Okay. And I think the message is we would like to be a partner as this industry moves forward, and if we keep that line of communication open when things begin to bubble up, it's easier for us to be helpful and not be a hindrance, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And it's working. And it's truly working, and I think that's absolutely what's appreciated and why this working group is here, and what we're trying to build is it, I think the industry knows that it needs to be that two-way communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those of us in aviation understand the need for exactly what you're bringing up. So we're happy to help. And if you ever, literally, if somebody would like to have more information or a detailed brief, you know, I'd be happy to come bring a drone. Sit down and get into more detail about what's happening in the laws and sort of all of the specifics about what's going on. That would be fine.
Okay. I see a field trip in our future. Oh, darn.
And then lastly, I just want to sort of get a big picture trend. You know, right now we're very disconnected. There's all of these things that you just brought up are in separate silos. But if you look at the trend of the industry, it's going to blend together as we go. And, you know, our target is really 2020, when we really start to see that sort of the benefit of the integrated operations. And the forecast from the FAA is 1.3 million drone pilots in 2020. So we're in a great spot. We want to make sure this is an open dialogue and leverage the tools that we have to make sure we do it right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Chair McEwen and committee members. Steve Christman, Airport Manager and Economic Development Director in Pendleton and at Eastern Oregon Regional Airport. We are very happy, as Mitch said, to have Boutique Air back, or a new airline back serving our airport. So it's very exciting. So I was attracted to this. I moved to Pendleton 4 years ago. I was attracted to this for a couple very clear reasons. Jobs, commerce, and to stop brain drain of our best and our brightest to the I-5 corridor. It's a big problem in rural Oregon, as we all know.
It certainly is.
So the low end of the salary range for this industry is $10,000 higher than the average annual salary in Pendleton, Oregon. So it attracted me for that reason. I also saw a very unique competitive advantage that we may be able to grasp to help draw high-tech and advanced manufacturing into a rural place where it wouldn't normally site due to skilled labor and other various things. So that was the attraction. I would be the first to admit, and I think these two gentlemen to my left would admit, it's been a long and painful first couple years. We have turned a big corner, though. The first 3 years, I think the Pendleton UAS range did less than a half dozen operations. In 2016 year to date, we've done 118 and counting. So it's very exciting. Thank you. This is, through the help of SOAR Oregon, which was funded with dollars through the Oregon Innovation Council, we've funded a Future Farm project, which brought a company from Virginia that has a satellite office now in Pendleton. They moved a pilot engineer there who's now working in our robotics, largest robotics competitive league in Oregon, is Eastern Oregon. We're very excited about it. I don't know what they're doing, eating and drinking in Helix, but apparently Little Helix, Oregon has phenomenal robotics kids. So those guys came out.
Competition in Triangle Lake, just so you know.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
We'll move around the state. Come compete there. It's been very exciting to see happen. Our high school, Pendleton High School, and the varying other rural Oregon high schools, our Blue Mountain Community College, very deeply involved in UAS now. All have courses. In fact, there's a 30-person course that BMCC is involved with right now, today, running all this week with folks from around the Northwest that have come out to take the course and paid good money to do it. So it's neat to see it evolve. That project that Digital Harvest, the company from Virginia, is involved in, is called the Future Farm, where they're integrating satellite data with drone data, with vehicle, ground-based vehicle data to irrigation pivots, to ground soil sensors, and feeding farmers real-time actionable information. It's attracting attention from companies around the world. It's very, very exciting to see happen. That's now spun off to a ground-based robotics program involving virtual reality that's based also at the Little Pendleton Terminal, which sat empty, I might add, for the last decade. So neat to see. Because of their relationship, Yamaha Motor Corporation has now come in and rented space in the terminal, again, that was sitting empty for many years. And so every couple weeks, engineers from Southern Cal come up to fly at the airport and surrounding areas. We've done operations in Echo, in Stanfield. We anticipate in the next year to be doing operations throughout Northeast Oregon, all the way over to Ontario and all over. So flight teams come in, 5 to 25 people. They'll stay. At absolute worst, you're looking at a lot of hotel stays and a lot of commerce. But you know, the end goal is jobs, and I think it's important to understand that that's a process. First, they're going to come to fly. They have to like what they find. We found that they do like what they find. That very quickly evolves to, do you have storage space for our vehicle? We don't want to tow it back and forth. Do you have an office space? Do you have a workshop? And we'll get to the manufacturing. We truly believe that. So it's been...
Is that the ultimate goal?
That would be a nice goal. I mean, we could... What this is about really is private industry seeing wanting to commercialize this technology and find uses for it. And I will say none of the uses we're dealing with are nefarious. I mean, these are all public safety, public health, search and rescue, farming, how to generate, higher yields using technology. So there are, I know that's always been a concern, but that is not what we are dealing with. And those companies are looking, they now have a pathway to commercialize their technology, and we want that to remain in Oregon, and to not put up any roadblocks that are going to halt them. We want them to follow that path in the state of Oregon, and I think they're going to do that at the three test ranges that we already possess, which we're very fortunate to possess in Pendleton, Tillamook, and Warm Springs. The fact that we've been outspent by other states, I have no idea, 100-1 or more, is and yet we're still a very attractive location that a lot of companies are looking to come to. We're dealing with no less than six Fortune 500 companies, most of them Fortune 100, that came to us. Well, I can tell you that being in rural Oregon now for 4 years, those types of suitors, unless you're building a data center or a food processing plant, pretty uncommon. And they came to us. They want something we have. And we'll take that all that opportunity all day long. So it's exciting.
I had the pleasure of having a presentation in our Ag and Natural Resources Committee, Representative McLean, 2 years ago now, probably, when this was just a beginning to emerge as an industry that could be really important to agriculture. And they were showing us examples of how drones with cameras and filters can show where crops are beginning to have issues with water, they're stressed, there's something going on with pests, and it was really impressive, and that was a couple of years ago, so I can imagine that that's evolved significantly. Are you bringing people in to train them for those types of applications?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what those folks are there this week for. There's a full class of students that came in from around the Northwest to learn how to utilize drones, utilize them legally, I only see this evolving. I mean, based on what I've seen in the last year and the folks we're talking to, which in 100 lifetimes I would not have thought would be seeking out Little Pendleton, Oregon, unless they really like rodeo, it's exciting to me. I think Oregon should be absolutely thrilled that we caught this on the very front edge of an emerging technology and make the most of it. I think it would be a monumental mistake to put up any roadblocks. I know that's not on the table at the moment, but let's take full advantage of this.
Yes, Mitch.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, I was remiss in not introducing Erlwin Stwyer, who's the Warm Springs Test Range Manager. She's also here, and Earl Bowerman, the Executive Director for SOAR, the new Executive Director for SOAR.
Good morning.
So I just wanted to make sure that you knew. And Warm Springs is working on firefighting technology.
Oh, wonderful. Please join us.
I just have one thing real quick.
I've got Representative McClain,
well,
Representative
this Wyman, is kind of a rhetorical question I just want to put out there, because I think everything you've said is amazing and exciting, and especially when you say the word jobs, you know, I mean, everybody perks up, and we definitely want rural Oregon to have all those jobs. I'm just thinking about my 15 and 17-year-old grandsons that keep talking to me about bots and about how I need to be real careful because, you know, that they're going to get tired of human frailty. And that they're going to keep working on it so that there's going to be more jobs for the bots and more jobs for the drones. And that I don't want to take jobs away from humans in Pendleton or Warm Springs or anyplace else. So I understand that right now we still have the human, you know, piece to that drone technology. But I think it's important to think forward as we, you know, think about all the different types of technology that could come out of all this, and just think long-term and short-term about what does the job scenario really look like. And again, you know, I mean, they keep talking to me about things that sound like science fiction, but not so much, because it looks like it's only 4 to 10 years out. So where are you guys going on what is the job outlook look short-term and long-term?
Sure, Representative McClain, that's a good question. And I will tell you that the big misnomer about drones is that they're unmanned. They're okay. Actually manned. The folks are just on the ground, not in the air. So that's one important distinction. I would also, and I don't mean to, Earl Bowerman is here from SOAR Oregon, which is the funded organization that funded us. They fund our range manager, the technical expertise necessary to run these ranges. Can I quote your jobs? 330 jobs right now in Oregon related to UAS. So this is a growing industry. You're going to see a lot of jobs. And I will say, living in ag country, agricultural labor is a huge issue. So robotics and the ability to force multiply your the limited human resources out there is a good thing. And we have more jobs than we have people, really. And so,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example on that. One of the reasons why Amazon really wants to do drone deliveries and automate is because don't quote me the exact numbers, but the number I was told is they have to hire something like 85,000 people a year for the deliveries and sort of the peak season of what goes on between now and sort of New Year's with their deliveries. A company like that can't physically hire enough people to keep up with their forecast of what the demand is going to be. So the reason why they wanted to get into this space is just based upon their sheer growth alone and trying to figure out how to manage the changes in how they're delivering and how they're doing things. So some of this is being driven just by the industry itself saying, okay, how are we going to grow and change and meet what we have to do in the future? So it's going to be a balance, and we're at an incredible time. But your points are very well taken, and it's something we have to pay attention to and understand very clearly what that roadmap is and what that means to us as a species.
Okay. Representative Lively.
Thank you. So I'm not looking for to put roadblocks, but I'm trying to understand the next decade or whatever it is. And you just mentioned Amazon and the delivery of products. So I see all these potential applications, especially in urban areas, and I'm trying to understand how all that works in the space in which they're allowed to operate, and that without creating some other issues, whether it's safety issues amongst the drones. I'm just trying to understand where all this is going and how that's going to be addressed.
Neith Maitsky, Wanishashnak Ishayat. Good morning. My name is Arlen Stwyer, and I work in this very male-dominated industry and enjoy it, thoroughly enjoy it. Warm Springs is on NASA's map, along with Madras, Central Oregon, for the solar eclipse 2017. We are among the longest viewing points in the country. And with that, we're the only location in which the solar eclipse is going to pass over a mountain. And so we're talking with NASA on a regular basis. In terms of jobs, we have wildland firefighters on the reservation that are learning how to use drones with firefighting. We are, as a sovereign nation, we can do a controlled burn. In May, we did one for 4,500 acres. And utilizing drones, the drones can drop the ignition fireballs. They can monitor the fire day or night through the smoke. They can make a map. They can deliver supplies. And so Warm Springs is very well known nationally for firefighting. We're going to work and rotate training with Yakima Nation, which has four times the land base that we do. Mm-hmm. Same with Colville, Umatilla, Nez Perce. And so we want to become a center of excellence for wildland firefighting, creating expertise and jobs. We are partnered with a business out of Portland, Oregon, and they have a patented rigging system for the safe lineman inspection of transmission lines. And we're working with Bonneville Power Administration. They have 20 miles of de-energized transmission line at Warm Springs. They've never used it. And so we have a safe mechanism for training. And what it looks like is I'm talking to the big boys back east. Exelon has 100,000 linemen. They're coming to Kaneda to our brand new training center that will open next month and creating more jobs. The linemen will come in and train for 4 days at Kaneda, staying there with all the amenities that we offer. And for 4 days, they'll be at the training center. On the last day, we'll take them out to do physical work with the drone and the rigging system.
Wow.
And 690 linemen fall to their death a year. And so this rigging system is a mechanism for transporting the linemen up and down in a safe manner, hands-free. And it's the only one of its kind in the country. We're with natural resources. We have 1,000 square miles of all type of terrain, forest and wildlife and what have you. The drones count the animals, the horses, the deer, the elk, the salmon. And so with the... We're in negotiations right now with the World Class Laboratory, who has an assignment from the White House. And we have experts that assist with that sophisticated customer on what research and development they're looking at doing. So they've narrowed their ranges to four different states, and Warm Springs is included and among the top four. And so they are currently at Nevada. They're not happy there. They've been there for 9 months, spending I don't know how much, $1,000 a week, and not getting the services. It takes them an hour and a half to get to this military-style barracks for their research and development, an hour and a half to any amenity. And they're just looking at a serious change to that research and development. By the end of January, we'll be notified as the two top ranges will be, and they'll set up a visit and give more detail and statement of work. And our pilots have top secret clearance from the FAA and also from the Department of Defense, and they have done this before with military experience and such. So it's rather fascinating industry to realize that we have probably the best pilots in the world here in Oregon. And so I've got one business out of China, MMCUAV, who actually met our business partner out of Portland at EPRI, the Research Association for Transmission Lines. And these gals are the fourth largest manufacturing company in China. They actually used to work for DJI, the number one manufacturer. And some of the employees branched out and started their own businesses. And so they are seriously wanting to start their business in Portland, Oregon. We team up with Business Oregon. We team up with SOAR Oregon to try to attract such companies to move here and create more jobs in manufacturing. Warm Springs, thank you, Business Oregon, infrastructure for the $500,000 infrastructure grant, $500,000 forgivable loan. All these other ranges, the other six ranges have millions of dollars of infrastructure. North Dakota just added $34 million. New York is at that level. Texas. And we're just barely getting our foot on the ground and building out the infrastructure, yet we're a part of that game and competing at that level, luring in China and Canada. They approach me at the shows and they say, "You're indigenous and we trust you. We want to work with you." And so it's something to realize that we have the capacity to get the certificate of authorization to fly faster than anybody else because we're a national test site. We can have them do the training, the research and development, evaluation, all in one place. Wonderful. Thank you.
If I can add on to...
Representative Hack had a question a while ago, so I'd like to give her an opportunity to step in.
And Steve, I'm glad you're back over there. Thank you, Madam Chair. A graduate of Pendleton High School, so just wanted to say congrats. Nice work.
Congrats.
Glad to hear that. We've heard a lot about stay out of our way, but I haven't heard anything about what can we do to help your industry. If there was something that the legislature could do that would help to enhance and move forward this great work, what would that be?
Finance.
For?
I think labor is a very important piece here. So the tech, this is a very, it's a language of their own, very esoteric world. They to have range manager, like our range manager is a retiree from Northrop Grumman with 29 years of flight test experience, who lives in Pendleton now, moved there from San Diego, loves it, by the way. And to have that kind of skilled labor is very important. And right now, SOAR Oregon is funding those positions at each of the three ranges. Mm-hmm. And so that's important. There will be, as we develop and get more and more customers, there will be more infrastructure needs potentially. I did want to speak quickly to Representative Lively's question. The beauty of this is it has to evolve in a rural place. This technology, the FAA will not set it free. It's not going to get tested at PDX. I mean, maybe someday once it's more mature, but and that really is the best part. It's a rare instance, I like to say, where nothing is a marketable asset. Having nothing in the sky and not much on the ground is something that lots of people need and want, and actually a diminishing resource in America. So, but I would say that labor and then just support for the industry marketing is a big deal. We are being outspent by many other states, but Oregon's got some real. We have very little in the air and very little in the sky in rural parts.
Follow up with one thing.
Yes.
So we're hearing workforce as an issue across the board with all industry. We brought in industry on the Small Business Committee, and it didn't matter if it was manufacturing or hotel restaurant or whatever. Workforce is the one issue that everybody had in common. So when you talk about a workforce, yours is very unique. And so could you give me just a 30-second, what's your workforce look like? Who are they? What are the qualifications? What are you looking for that would enhance your workforce? Who are those people?
Sure. Well, sir, in my company, we employ pilots, computer programmers, pretty much people, if you think about it, in general high tech. Now, the unique thing about being a pilot in this industry is that you don't need to have a college degree. So, you know, our pilots, one's a former Horizon Airlines pilot. Another one's a military and Air Force person without a college degree. So it's very, you know, the nice thing about pilots, it's a skill set that you can train to. The computer, obviously, programming, that's obviously a specialized skill set that you need a lot of background in. But it's pretty much the general, I think if you think of the high-tech industry, kind of a very generalized situation, and then you add in sort of the aviation components.
I would add to that that in Pendleton, we're very fortunate. We happen to have an Army National Guard unit at the airport. It's the top Army National Guard drone unit in the nation. So we have some very specialized labor already there. Our CTE program at the high school was awarded a big grant this past year and started a drone program involving ground-based robotics
as
well.
Is that a revitalization grant?
I believe so.
CTE revitalization grant. Congratulations.
Yeah,
hard
thank
to come
you.
By.
Well, they're doing. Congratulations to the high school. They did all the work, and they're doing just a heck of a job. The kids are eating it up. I think involving the youth and we already have the middle school now getting involved. So involving them at a young age and grooming them to be. And we have the individuals now with the labor, with our range manager, and the Army National Guard to impart this knowledge on them and train them up.
And if you look at the forecast, it's not going to be a specialized set of operators. It's really going to be the real estate agents. It's going to be the roofers, the insurance agents. I mean, that's the future of this technology and where it's really going to go when it really truly commercializes. It's going to commoditize, and it's going to be the local industries that are using things in ways that we aren't really understanding today. So it's going to kind of morph in. Right now we're specialized, but it's really going to broaden as its application gets more and more common.
So specifically at Warm Springs, when I'm talking to the young people that are curious about what are the possibilities here, you can take after August, you can take a class for a couple of days, and they're offered. I went to one through Oregon UAS, and it was for only one day, and it costed me $299 mm-hmm. plus $150 for the FAA test, and I'm a qualified commercial pilot for drones. Wow. And so the less than $500 to take that license test. And then we have...
Excuse me one second. What does that license test do for you? So what I'm most familiar with is the agricultural application. So if I have a farm out in Pendleton or have a ranch out in Pendleton and I want to have someone come and fly over a field so I can see what's going on. So would that certification allow that farmer or that farmer's employer, that rancher's employee, then to actually go out and do that work for that landowner?
That person would be a qualified commercial FAA licensed pilot for drones, yes.
But does is it prudent for that landowner to hire a licensed pilot is what I'm trying to get at. What's the benefit of having the license, or can I just go fly it?
According to the to be legal, they have to be licensed.
Okay.
So that is the requirement under the FAA Part 107 rules. So that is what the purpose of that is. The FAA has to have some way to manage, ensure that people have a basic level of understanding of what the airspace mm-hmm. regulations are, and that's what the Part 107 exam does. Is it makes you legal. It doesn't, the challenge is, it's not a skill test. It's a written test, mm-hmm. and that meets the FAA mm-hmm. requirements. Mm-hmm.
But then does that indemnify that in a landowner for with this insurance if he's got somebody flying a drone?
It's up to them to go get their own insurance. Now, best practice would say you'd have, you know, our company would carry $10 million worth of liability insurance. So that's what our best practice is, and that's what the companies that we work for sort of dictate. Mm-hmm. But from an insurance standpoint, it's up to that company then to get whatever level they need.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
So the type of jobs that I was bringing up, they could work for our range as an observer, and so some of our clients require observers to be on location for safety purposes. They could also work at our manufacturing plant. We'll be manufacturing the Easy Rig drone in February. And they could also we're putting together a drone park out at Kaneda, a large netting for FPV racing, for the kiddos to learn how to fly a drone. So once there's an enclosure, it's not considered airspace by the FAA. And we can invite developers from the Gorge, from Portland, from Bend. Bend is a mecca nowadays of outdoor adventures. And there's a huge growth in the drone arena.
So it's a recreational opportunity is what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
I think you'll see some farmers that want to do it themselves, and then others are going to contract it out, just like you contract out crop dusting and
sure.
other services. So you've seen an explosion nationwide of aerial service providers that are scanning power lines and wind turbines and those sorts of things.
Great. Any questions? Great. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I know the gentleman from SOAR, would you like to jump in here? We're doing fine on our time today, and as long as you're here, there may be some opportunities to pick your brain as well.
Thank you. Chair McKeon, my name is Earl Bowerman.
McKeon. Thank you. Happens all the time.
Yeah. Okay. Earl Bowerman, Executive Director of SOAR Oregon. I'd love to answer any questions that you have.
Well, I guess the one question that I had, I really appreciated you coming up and giving us a specific example of how it's being developed in your area on the Warm Springs. And so I guess I'm asking, what you've told us you've got these three sites, and so are you the contractor that actually brings the workforce into these three sites?
So we are funded by the state of Oregon. So in the last biennium, we were funded at $3 million. Mm-hmm. Our oversight is to be a resource, a technical resource, and a financial resource to growing the industry in Oregon. So we basically, for VDOS, he's a partner, so we funded their startup. We also fund all the technical resources for range managers at the three test sites. So currently, we have about 1.5 million of that three allocated to startup companies in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So we give them allocation. They perform to their plan, and then every quarter we review that for the next disbursements. Okay. So we are looking at the next biennium and what the funding will be like. So the critical piece that we've seen, the trend from 2015 to 2016, is that 2015, they probably did a couple dozen of flights, but as soon as the test ranges were funded with a range manager and got that technical resource that could talk to the technical level of the customer, it created this huge confidence. And this year, we'll see approximately 160 flights across the test ranges. The goal for the first 12 months of the funding for the test ranges was about $500,000 in revenue. We're close to 700,000 right now. So we're exceeding the goals that we were given. And what we've seen for 2016 is about a $4.8 million indirect revenue to those communities. So when those flight crews come in and they stay for long periods of time, it's a huge growth. What we're seeing for 2017 already, we have contracts and commitments that's going to bring revenue right now, probably in Q1, Q2, of $1.1
million. Okay.
But our funding is in jeopardy, and we're not really sure how we're going to manage those contracts coming forward beyond June.
Okay. Representative Lively.
So, and I apologize, I probably should know this, but I'd like to understand a little bit more your background or the group's background, your qualifications that have, that provide you the opportunity to do what you're doing.
My personal, 26 years executive at Intel. I'm also a fixed wing pilot. I'm also a certified 107 pilot. I've worked in many different industries in medical device, aviation. Spent several years COO of renewable energy. So we used to build solar power plants and also on the inverter side. Mm-hmm. So I come from a technical background. And an aviation background as well.
That. Thank you.
Sure.
Sounds like you're having fun.
Oh, this is the best come out of retirement job.
Never. Good for you.
Wonderful. Any other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for traveling here. Get
thank
out of
you.
Town because the weather's going to get bad.
Yeah, especially
thank
Pendleton.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate it very much. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the drone industry and open an informational hearing or a briefing on work that has been done by Business Oregon on the Willamette Valley Intermodal Transload Facility Feasibility Study. Gentlemen, welcome. Gentlemen and ladies, welcome. And I would also, while we're changing panels, like to take a moment and welcome Representative-elect Mark Meek. Mark, raise your hand. Mark is newly elected to House District number
40.
Thank you. And will be joining us at our swearing-in day on January 9th. And I just wanted to let you know Mark's in the room, and he's here learning a little bit about transportation. And thank you for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Kevin Mannix is on there, too. Kevin Mannix.
Oh, and Mr. Mannix. Welcome. Thank you for joining us as well.
Former representative.
And what district did you represent, sir?
132. Yeah. Now Brian Clem's district with another number, which I can't
remember. Oh, 21? Does that sound right? Something like that.
Close.
Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Ken.
Good. You bet. Gentlemen, you have a study to present to us.
Chair McEwen,
we'll let
members
you open
of the committee.
It up, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you very much for having me. For the record, my name is Chris Cummings, and I'm the Assistant Director for Infrastructure Finance at Business Oregon. With me, I have Carl Batten and Sarah Reich from Eco Northwest, who are the authors of this study. But before we get into all the great work that they did, I just wanted to give a little bit of background on how we got here today. In the 2016 legislature, Business Oregon was awarded $100,000 to do a feasibility study for an intermodal container yard transload transfer facility within the valley. And we'll get into why I say transload and transfer facility in a few minutes when Sarah takes over. But for now, because I'm so used to saying transload, you may hear me say that. We're leaning towards transfer in the future. Part of this comes about after years and years of discussion on does it make sense to have this sort of facility in the Valley. Also comes about from the governor's transportation visioning panel, where there was a recommendation that the state look further into transload facilities, as well as the trade and logistics study, which was a study issued by the state to look at how we could help our shippers and farmers with the loss of container service at T6 in Portland. So transload container facility has been mentioned for decades by stakeholders across the state, or across the region, I should say. But before we get into Sarah's presentation and Carl's presentation, I'd like to just let you know what we're talking about. On the picture here, we have a container. And what we did a study on was these containers, frankly, are just loaded with product, right? And they get shipped, they get put on a train, on a truck, on a ship, overseas, east, where have you. They've revolutionized the shipping industry. So a lot of product gets shipped in these. What we wanted to look at was a facility that takes these from truck and puts them on a train and vice versa. Nothing more. Not reloading them, doing anything further with them except moving them from train to truck, truck to train in the Valley. This facility, which Sarah will lay out for you, the other thing that we looked at was some style of what we might need in a facility, some of the costs that may be needed to get it up and running. But what we didn't look at is whether it's a good idea for you to invest in. That's a policy decision that we're leaving up to the legislature. What we did look at was, is it feasible? Is it possible to make it work, given the right circumstances?
Or somebody else could invest in.
Correct.
To be the legislature.
Yes, the state or private sector or anybody. And there's quite frankly a bit of interest on both sides about this study.
Representative McLean has a question.
So I just want to say this is sort of a rhetorical question, so maybe you'll point to it if you've got information on it. When we went around the state, you know, we heard all kinds of information about we don't want anything, any container to go home empty. And so does anything in this report help us with the idea? I mean, you're talking, it sounds like, can we do this? Can we get it from truck to train and train to truck? But did you do anything as far as reloading? Did you say no?
As Chairman Kuhn, Representative McLean, as far as reloading the container itself, no, that's not what we looked at. We looked at the transfer and movement of the containers from the Valley to other areas.
Okay.
Chairman McKeown, Representative
For the record, my name is Carl Batten. I'm with Echo Northwest in Portland. Mm-hmm. And the Willamette Valley is different from most of the United States in that there are far fewer full containers coming into the Valley with imports than there are full containers leaving the Valley with exports. So to make a facility like this work, not only will it have to get access to the import containers coming into the Valley, let the shippers fill them up with their agricultural products or whatever and get them on a truck or train headed to a port, but they'll also have to be able to get a number of empty containers from the ports into the Valley to be filled.
Which is a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So with that, I think we'll just turn it over to Sarah. And
Ms. Reich, welcome to our committee. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Representative McKeown. And so again, for the record, my name is Sarah Rich. And
I apologize. Happens to me constantly. Rich.
I'm used to it,
Ms.
too.
Rich.
No problem.
Thank you.
Sure. I'm with Echo Northwest and here to present the results of our study. So Chris has given you a good overview of the background here that this slide goes over. Again, the driving factors the conversation around this facility, I think, has been going on for more than a decade. Some of the more recent events precipitated this actual study, and it provided some more recent context to that informed the interviews that we had and the experiences that shippers are dealing with right now. So the recent closure of the port and, in general, people looking for opportunities to and options to increase resiliency. We were doing our study in the middle of the bankruptcy of Hanshin. Yes. And so that was just another reminder that nothing is ever constant in this industry, and agricultural shippers in particular are always looking for, you know, the best ways and the cheapest ways to get their goods to market. So increasing the resiliency, and then, you know, dealing with the increasing congestion challenges in the I-5 corridor all the way up. So those are some of the driving factors that inform the context. And Chris talked about this, but I'll just reiterate that when we started this, we were dealing with looking at an intermodal transload facility. And as we started doing the interviews, it created a lot of confusion. People wanted to know if we were talking about actually reloading and unloading containers. Mm-hmm. And it was very clear that that wasn't what people had in mind when they asked the question that we were asked to answer. So the suggestion for the wording that we should be using is a transfer facility, and that simply means just transferring the box from one mode of transportation to another, not reloading the box. Mm-hmm. Reloading the box, you know, that is a legitimate service that some facilities provide, transloading from either van line truck containers to intermodal containers or back, or, you know, from smaller, larger containers to smaller containers to larger containers. Mm-hmm. So we're not looking at those. Our facility doesn't contain the equipment necessary or the facilities necessary to do that. It does provide the specialized equipment, the lifts, to lift containers from truck chassis to rail cars and back, and between different types of truck chassis. If necessary. For that reason, it has to be located on a rail line, and providing space for assembling trains is one of the more critical characteristics of the facility. So, again, to clarify what we were asked to do, we were asked to look at the focus on the business case for an ITF. And so the steps involved in that are looking at the size of the market, how many containers are we talking about, and then the factors influencing demand. Will people actually want to use the facility, and at what, with what characteristics, at what prices, those kinds of things. From that, we looked at the potential revenue that that activity could generate, and the costs that would be required to actually build and operate the facility. We were also asked to preliminarily look at addressing the what the need for public investment would be to make this a go. Could it happen without public investment? If not, in general, what might that look like without, you know, a specific analysis? And focusing on strategies that might be useful in facilitating public investment. And then we were asked to just qualitatively identify and describe the potential benefits to the public. So if public investment might be needed, what are the benefits that might justify some of that investment? So our analysis, we reported it in two technical memoranda. So if you have any detailed questions, we have an executive summary and then two detailed memoranda that detail the assumptions and the actual numbers that go into the costs and the capital costs and operating costs and those things.
And I believe these are on OLIS. Are these both on OLIS as well?
I think they are. They must be.
All three. I know the executive summary is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. So today I'm just going to step through the steps of what we did in our analysis and report the highlights of our findings. So the first step was looking at the size of the market for the ITF, and for that we started by identifying what the geography of the study area might look like. And so we determined that the blue highlighted counties there are the most likely areas that would utilize such a facility located in the Willamette Valley, the coast, the southern Oregon, and the valley north to Salem. And we say in the report Salem. The map does have entirety of Marion County identified, but it's unlikely that, based on our conversations with shippers, that northernmost nub of Marion County likely wouldn't. They would utilize the existing facilities in Portland.
Excuse me, was there a conversation? I know there's a
fairly large market for compressed alfalfa being shipped to Japan from over east. Was that part of this conversation?
We looked at hay and other products like that going out of eastern Oregon, and it seemed that they would continue to use the facility out of Boardman or that corridor. The central and eastern Oregon growers.
Head north.
And then anybody in the northwestern Oregon or the upper valley would likely, because of the cost involved,
they wouldn't come south to go north.
Wouldn't go south.
Right. Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. So past studies that have attempted to quantify the number of containers coming out of an area have relied on a data source called the Port Import Export Recording Service, or PIRS data. And there, we looked into doing that as well. There are some challenges with that data set that you can overcome, and to some extent, the challenges involved in the records not identifying very well the originating location of the containers. And so when you're looking at actually trying to identify, you know, the potential market for a facility in a certain place, knowing where the containers are originating is critical, or very helpful. And so instead, we looked at a data set that was de-identified Oregon phytosanitary certificates, and those more closely identify, you know, these are the containers that are leaving leaving the valley.
Can you explain what a phytosanitary certificate is? Because I had no clue when I read that.
Absolutely. Carl, you want to do that?
I'll attempt. It's a certificate that is required for many agricultural products to that certifies that they have been properly fumigated or whatever else has to happen.
Condition
to
of
them.
The container.
It's the condition of the agricultural products, and it doesn't include like frozen or canned agricultural products, mm-hmm. but it does include most of the agricultural products that are shipped from the valley.
Thank you.
And those certificates are, as I understand, not required for export, but they are required generally on the other side for import. And so every product that goes out that would be imported in another country would have a phytosanitary certificate before it leaves the U.S.
And Hawaii,
yes. And there were some containers where that was relevant, so exports to Hawaii. We had this as a fairly large data set that we poured through and spent some time mapping total quantities to the number of containers that would be required to transport those quantities. Sometimes the certificate identifies that it's quantity of a product in a container. Other times it's a quantity of a product that we know goes by container, and it may, you know, so we worked to determine how many containers would be required to transport that kind of that amount of product. And we also, after going through the data set, or concurrent with, we worked with interviewers of shippers of those commodities to spot check and actually determine that we were making the correct assumptions in that crosswalk. Mm-hmm. So, the primary exports that we identified through that database were straw, hay, lumber and wood products, potatoes, seeds and grains, and nursery stock. And with nursery stock, I want to there was quite a bit of it coming out of Oregon, but most of that originates out of the northern part of the Willamette Valley.
Those Christmas trees?
Christmas trees are also
or live plants?
Both. Well, so nursery stock doesn't include Christmas trees.
There we go.
But the phytosanitary certificates do identify Christmas trees and greenery, most of those, I'll get to that in a minute, most of those weren't included in our analysis as well. Nursery stock, we included a small amount from the Southern Valley. I think it was blueberry plants.
Live plants.
Thank you. Live plants. And then we knew that some exports were relevant that were not likely in the phytosanitary certificate database, the largest of those being pulp from the Southern Valley. And so we did some direct interviews to determine the likely quantity there. And so getting to your question, exports considered but excluded, the exports that were actually in the database that we excluded, most of the nursery stock just because it was outside of the study area. And And then the Christmas greenery and trees, those are very time sensitive, likely not, wouldn't use the facility even if it were located. They got to get them out on time. And there's a fairly small number of Christmas trees that are actually exported out of, that go to Hawaii. There's not a huge market for Christmas trees in Asia. So we know that we also did not quantify processed manufactured food products. As Carl mentioned, the frozen and canned or otherwise processed agricultural products, manufactured wood products and metal products. It's likely that those are a small number of containers relative to those that are quantified. That's what we heard in our interviews. And then we also did not acknowledge or quantify domestic shipments. And this is something that came up in our interviews a lot. Well, you know, here's my exports, international exports, but I've also got a lot of domestic shipments. What about those? And that was explicitly outside of the scope of our study, and it's also more difficult to identify the number of containers because you don't have a database like PIRS or the phytosanitary certificates for those products.
Do you have some sense of what you've disqualified here, what percentage of a freight movement that might comprise? I mean, any idea? Because it looks like that could be a...
Based on our interviews with manufacturers, we believe that the processed and manufactured products is a relatively small number of containers. We believe that the domestic shipments could be a very large volume of agricultural products, mm-hmm. most of it not actually in containers, but in truck trailers. So if the facility were to be set up to handle those, it would need some additional equipment to be able to lift truck trailers onto a different type of rail car than the container handling products.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So here's just a visual representation of the breakdown. You can see that straw overwhelmingly is the largest export. That wasn't a surprise to us based on what we've been told in our interviews. Pulp is also fairly large, lumber and wood products. The potatoes, which you can't see the percentage there on the slide.
It's great.
And the nursery stock, again, is very small amount. But straw is where it's at.
So your biggest volume probably has the lowest margin.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. Yeah, so just to put this in the comparison, the Tioga report that was released earlier this year did use the PIRS data service to quantify the number of containers coming out of the Mid-Valley, and they did some adjustments to try to make sure that they were looking at, that. I don't know exactly what they did, but they determined that it was about 30,000 containers in 2014, so that compares to the 38,170. It's not a direct comparison, apples to apples, but you can see that we're in the ballpark. And our number was, in fact, a little bit larger than what they identified. And again, getting back to the question about imports, based on the PIRS data, it looks like approximately 9,000 containers coming into the valley, and that, based on our interviews with people, seemed it should have been a much smaller number than the exports. So, okay, so after determining the size of the market, we looked at demand, and the conclusions here largely came from our interviews with shippers, freight forwarders, so agricultural producers and representatives of them, freight forwarders, other operators. We worked with staff from Northwest Container Services also to understand the rail components and how that business already operates here in Oregon. But the shippers helped us understand the demand and how, under what characteristics they would use the facility or be likely to use the facility, and also what their current costs are and how they move goods right now. Because if we have to understand what they're doing right now to understand how doing something different would compare. So this often comes up, shippers still trying to figure out what to do after the closure of T6. And from the interviews that we did, it sounds like they've pretty much gotten into a groove again of how they're shipping. They've adjusted to the new market conditions, basically. There was some challenges with reliability after in the months following the closure of T6 and challenges with both truck and rail reliability and how are we going to do this. That reliability has stabilized a lot. And like I said, the shippers seem to have mostly adjusted to the new set of options and prices. The thing that came out clearest in the interviews was that demand for the ITF would be influenced by the characteristics of the alternatives, price, but importantly, non-price factors. Shippers are sensitive to price, but really care about issues related to reliability and other things. I'll get into that more here. We wanted to identify, as we were talking with the shippers, we realized very quickly that determining the cost of just the transportation portion of getting a container to port is a much more complicated question than you would expect. And that's because of the way that the containers are priced and what kinds of services are included in that price. When you reserve a container, what are you paying for? And sometimes you're paying for part of the transportation, or the ocean carrier is paying for part of that transportation and essentially passing it through in the cost of the container. So we sought to isolate just the transportation portion of the container cost, not looking at what it costs to get the container across the ocean, but just that portion to the port so that we could compare apples to apples across the options. Because sometimes, so these are the two primary options that shippers use right now. This is looking at containers going out of the ports of Seattle and Tacoma. We do know that some containers may be going south out of Oakland, but we're focusing on the containers going out of the ports of Seattle and Tacoma. Right now, shippers are either using the Northwest Container Services facility in Portland, so they're trucking to that facility, and then it goes onto rail to the ports, or they're trucking directly through and bypassing the rail. And based on our interviews and setting some assumptions that that it's a round trip, so they're going up, getting an empty container, bringing it down, filling it, and taking it back up, so it's a round trip. And we're looking at the facility somewhere in the Mid-Valley, so the distances are based on that. The round trip cost for the trucking and rail option is about $1,200, the round trip cost for the trucking option. This also assumes that the most of the agricultural products coming out of the valley require are really heavy and require a 3 or 4 axle trailer, which adds to the cost of just a standard chassis. So that's built in here to the assumptions, and that cost is approximately $1,450. We work directly with the freight forwarders and the people who provide the trucking services to put those numbers to the trucking numbers together here. And so like I said before, the non-price factors, which are really important to shippers, include time. How long is it going to take to get to the port? And in general, time is better than more time. Also, flexibility in how in that getting it to port is important. So, they may only have a day or two to, based on when the product is available and when it needs to get to the ship, and don't always have days and days built into that. So time was a really important factor. Reliability, so time, making sure that the container actually gets to the ship before the ship line sails, because missing that carrier cutoff time can lead to a lot of additional expenses. And then another one that came up over and over was container availability. Actually, when you book a spot on an ocean carrier, you have to use the container that they provide, or you have to use their container. You can't just get any container. And being able to locate that container at the right time and have it be the right container, 40-foot high cube, for instance, or a reefer if you need the refrigerated capacity, or a 20-foot if that's what you're looking at. The ocean carriers tend to have the largest stock at the port itself in Seattle and Tacoma. There's some storage of containers at Northwest Containers Facility in Portland, but the mix of containers may not include the one that you need. So getting the right container at the right place at the right time was an important factor and influenced a lot of shippers in actually just going directly to the port to get their equipment because they knew it would be there and they wouldn't experience delays if it wasn't in Portland. For many shippers, these non-price factors favored the truck over the rail. Even though the truck was expensive, they went that direction. And shippers with higher volumes, in some cases, saw more benefit with rail because it just was they didn't have to deal with securing a large number of chassis or trucks or the details involved, and the rail was simpler and more streamlined for those with large volumes, but not all of them with large volumes.
And when you say high volume, that's the compressed straw, the alfalfa guys?
A higher number of containers.
Okay.
So based on our interviews, we developed estimates for the potential transportation costs at the ITF itself. And these are, it involved some assumptions because the facility doesn't exist and the service doesn't exist in the valley. We then compared the costs of the ITF with the current options. And I want to say the uncertainty in option three's costs, you'll see the options here, are higher, are highest for two reasons. The first is that local trucking costs are highly variable, depending on how they arrange to get the container from the load point to the ITF. The costs, we heard a wide range. There's a certain threshold of cost that you have to get to just secure a truck and a chassis. And so it doesn't start really small, but shippers can be creative, especially at smaller distances. And so the local trucking costs are highly variable. And then the cost of rail service is dependent on many unresolved issues, including how many rail cars would be required, the frequency of service, which railroads might be involved. So we extrapolated from the current rail costs that we were able to identify for option one to come up with a rail cost for option three. It may be higher or lower than the actual cost when those factors actually end up. But based on these assumptions, we found that option three costs getting goods to the ports of Seattle and Tacoma using the Willamette Valley ITF would be approximately the same cost as using the Portland facility, less than the trucking cost still. And as we talked to people, they thought it was important to emphasize that you see option three only export if we were able to have more imports into the valley, more importers covering the cost of that leg of the trip, the cost to get the you eliminate half of the round trip essentially in some of the cost.
And was there conversation about, and I'm sure you considered this, that we have, I think it's in Lebanon, a large warehousing where I think Lowe's and some other larger distribution centers are. Mm-hmm. They're bringing in containers, I assume, that are going out empty. They're coming in and offloading. Is that correct? I mean, was that a consideration in this calculation?
It was not directly in this calculation. It came up a lot in the interviews. And they're currently, there's some challenges to that an ITF may alleviate in some ways. But the equipment currently the reason why it's not happening right now is often the containers are on chassis that are standard weight.
Okay.
And the agricultural products need the three or four axle chassis. And the other issue there is the mismatch of container equipment type, the ship lines, aligning shipper, exporter, and importer needs is a complicated task. And, one exporter may need 10 containers from this ship line, and that just may not be available in the valley because the importer used a different ship line, and so they can't use those same containers. So it's a complicated logistics problem that, like I said, the ITF may alleviate quite a bit, but it's not a silver bullet in terms of solving the problem. Problems remain. Okay. So the preliminary conclusions from our market analysis, the ITF is not always the cheapest option, but it's not the most expensive either. Shippers do not always choose the least cost option, and that's an important point. A lot of them are trucking, and even though those costs may be higher because of the other non-cost factors that shipping or trucking provides. And again, if the ITF is to be successful and capture the demand that is in the valley, paying attention to those factors other than cost are important. Paying attention to cost is also important. Okay, so getting to the facility itself, this is a schematic of the type of facility that would be required to perform the services that we've talked about. Approximately 14 acres is the size that would be needed. Being in the valley and dealing with the climate conditions we have down there, being paved is important, and that does add to the cost. Fence perimeter, and then 6,000 feet of track, two working tracks of 3,000 feet to accommodate the unit train sizes that would be required to make this work. And then its location is important, too, located on the main line. Because those truck transportation costs are so critical, being as close to major highway as possible would be important. And then the roads around the ITF would need to be capable of handling the heavyweight agricultural products, those heavyweight trucks, and then the quantity going through.
Was there conversation? I know, there's always been difficulty with steel and paper barriers mm-hmm. with BNSF and UP.
Yep, we got I think that's coming.
Is that kind of, okay, I'll let you get to it.
Yeah.
It's an important conversation.
It is. So based on, we developed some scenarios based on the conversations with, we had preliminary conversations with Union Pacific and PNW. We did reach out to BNSF, and they didn't return our inquiries for an interview. But based on what we heard from them and then discussions with staff at Northwest Container Services, we came up with a range of scenarios that the primary variant there is container volume. Number of trains per week and number of containers per train is how we assembled the scenarios. But the range is approximately 5,000 containers per year all the way up to 76,000 approximately containers per year. And that upper limit is pegged to the total number of containers that we identified in our market analysis, and we understand that it's unlikely that this facility would capture 100% of the market. It's important to acknowledge that. But if the facility were also able to handle domestic containers, it's possible that we could end up with that level of volume. And we wanted to show the full range and how container volume influences.
I think Representative Pack has a question.
Thank you, Chair. She heard me over here whispering to myself. So that's a pretty large spread from 5,000 to 76. So when you look at an ROI, how do you even begin to say where we're at there in relation to 5,000 to 76,000?
So we'll get there. Okay. Yeah, we do show that.
Thank you.
The wide range was really important because it's clear that the initial operating volume may be very low for the factors that we've already talked about, the challenges in using rail and getting agricultural shippers to change their current mode of transportation to others. It may take a while to prove this. So starting with the low container volume was really important. And the short lines may be willing to actually haul those low container volumes. So putting that into the mix just to show the feasibility at that level and what might be required from the public investment side, we thought was important. And then going all the way up, like I said, to the to the higher volumes, you can see that container volume is really critical in making this facility work. So that's why we had the large range. Okay, and then the facility size is fixed across all of those scenarios because there's just a certain configuration that's required to provide these services, and this facility would be able to serve up to the higher end capacity. Some of the costs do scale with volume. The higher volumes of containers require additional lift equipment just to keep those containers moving onto trains and coming off of trains. And with the extra lift equipment comes additional employees to operate the lift and then the cost involved in operating those lifts. So the capital costs, not including the land, would be about $7 million. And then the annualized capital costs, which includes the carrying cost of the land, would be in the $600,000 to $700,000 range. And per container at those volume scenarios, so the higher volume scenario, it would be about $9 per container. The lowest volume scenario would be about $120 a container. So you see how that really influences things. Operating costs, again, those fixed operating costs, would be about $200,000 a year, and then the variable operating costs are range because of that wide range, so the $13,000 to about $300,000. So we have a range of total operating costs, and the per container costs are about $7 to $45 per container. So the total, there you go, costs range from $15 per container to $165 per container. So to come up with, you know, whether this is feasible, we look at the revenues. And the general range that the industry charges per lift, which is basically one container moving through the facility, it may be lifted several times during that period, but only one lift is charged. So one container moving through the facility, the typical charge is between $20 and $50. Some facilities charge more, some may charge less, but that was the range that we narrowed in on. The Class 1 railroads typically charge at the higher end of the range, and based on the laws of demand, lower container fees would likely result in higher volumes of containers, and higher fee would result in lower volumes built into, or so we use that assumption to determine the actual range, the likely range of revenue here, which would be somewhere between almost $300,000 to $1.5 million per year. So here's that kind of break even. You can see it illustrated across the range of scenarios. At the higher volumes, your costs are lower than your revenues, and you know, you have a facility that can operate without public support potentially. And at the lower volumes, the revenues may cover the operating costs, but not the capital costs, and then they may not cover the total amount of either. So, what?
At the lowest.
At the lowest volume, yeah. Lowest volumes. Okay, so going back to those factors that shippers told us were important, that illuminates some opportunities to improve feasibility. The bottom line here is that feasibility improves as volume increases. So how do you get volume up? You can keep costs to shippers lower, so going with those lower lift fees. But then cost may not be the only factor here. If train service is only once a week, there's a lot of shippers who may not even consider this facility because it's just not moving things, doesn't provide the time or the reliability factors that they're looking for. The other important consideration is how the ITF will what kind of equipment availability it will offer. There won't be a lot of space there to store containers. If the ocean carriers are willing to put the equipment that is needed on the trains coming down and getting it there at the time that the shipper needs it and can pick it up, then, you know, equipment availability may be almost as good as at the port. But if those kinds of operations aren't happening as shippers would expect, then they may be forced to go up to the port to get the equipment and bypass the use of the ITF. So equipment availability requires cooperation with the ocean carriers, and it also requires coordination and logistical integration between the importers and the exporters.
Which it sounds from what you said is challenging.
Well, somebody has to be available to do that. You know, who does it? Individual shippers don't have those communication lines necessarily. So the questions about public sector investment, there are several ways that the public sector may consider providing support for the facility. Part of that is financial. So through providing land directly, which would reduce the capital costs, guaranteeing bonds, which may reduce the financing costs and overall reduce the capital costs, directly subsidizing capital costs or subsidizing the operating costs for a period of time, especially as it's getting established and operating at those lower volumes. But there are other ways that the public sector can facilitate the launching this, I guess. Coordination with the railroads is essential. Like I said, we had preliminary conversations with the railroads.
With both class ones?
No.
Short lines?
With Union Pacific and PNW. Like I said, we reached out to BNSF, but didn't hear back.
So if those, this is hypothetical, if you could remove those paper and steel barriers, which is way above our pay grade, that's going to happen 3,000 miles from here, or at least halfway, would that impact this analysis? How would that impact this analysis?
So the paper barriers, as I understand, the maybe the biggest one is between using the short line PNW in the valley and then getting transferring cars to UP. Currently, if they can't transfer containers or rail cars when that originate on BNSF track to UP. And so that would limit the range of options in, it would restrict it to BNSF carrying the freight up to the ports. And
if you were queen of the world and that paper barrier could be removed, would that change your analysis?
I don't know. That depends on the what the two class one carriers, what their interest is.
And there's some competition for rates.
Yeah. But that would depend on their interest. And right now, UP, based on the preliminary conversations, you know, they were only interested in, say, it was unclear exactly what their interest in what was in this facility, but it wasn't enthusiastic.
Of course not.
And they would require much higher thresholds of trains to operate. They wouldn't consider hauling small numbers of containers.
Right.
So that almost requires the involvement of the short line, and then you get back to the paper barriers.
Same
here.
Thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess I have one.
Representative McLean.
So when you're looking at this, I mean, it's changing travel patterns, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it could have a plus for less congestion in Portland. But they're also, with all these trains, you've got the passenger trains and the freight trains. And so we already have some issues with sharing the tracks.
Yeah.
And so is that part of that?
Those would certainly be issues to address. And right now that has, as I understand, has affected to some degree reliability with the congestion and the I-5 corridor north of Portland,
mm-hmm.
Especially with construction going on.
Up and north, up in Washington?
Yeah. So you add more trains to that, and that increases the challenge of making sure trains arrive on time at the port.
Anyway, I don't know if I saw that in any of your analysis, you know, talking about, you know, I mean, some of the cost is going to depend on if they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's changing traffic patterns for the trains or train, you know, volume for the trains, whether you're at your low number or your high number,
mm-hmm.
there's still some elements of concern there, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I would imagine that would potentially impact the rate that the railroad is willing to charge. And then that also leads to some public benefits and costs that we specifically didn't look at.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, changing congestion,
okay.
changes cost.
Air quality.
Yeah.
All of those things, that the trucks off the highway,
mm-hmm.
the benefit, social benefit. Yeah.
But that's not part of the report.
No.
Not directly.
No.
The other factor that the public may, public sector may be able to facilitate is conversations with the ocean carriers and garnering support from them and actually moving containers down inland. They tend to be a little more reluctant right now, as I understand, given the market conditions of putting equipment, moving equipment away from the port because it increases their opportunity cost for that equipment. They can't turn it around as quickly if it's sitting in the valley. And we're not really talking about a facility that will have a lot of storage, but still that willingness to move the containers and make sure that the shippers in the valley have the equipment
mm-hmm.
at a time when they need it. Would be helpful, especially in just getting the confidence of the shippers who deal with this all the time. There's some skepticism that part of it would work out.
Sure.
And then the other piece of this is somehow coordinating with the larger imports, either increasing container imports into the valley, if that would be if there are possible ways to do that, or just making those connections between importers and exporters and equipment needs. And here, this is to your point there. There are potentially some public benefits associated with this related to congestion costs and then the air pollution, greenhouse gas, things related to that. But we didn't quantify any of this.
Okay.
But it is well established in the literature that there are some benefits there.
As congestion increases, which we know it's going to, mm-hmm. that may have an impact as well.
Yeah.
A few years down the road when that whole scenario becomes...
Yeah, you know, that has the potential to change some of those cost
population
factors
increases
for everybody.
Are dramatic. And, mm-hmm. yeah. Great questions. This has been very thorough. Thank you, Ms. Rich. Any comments, sir? Mr. Cummings.
No, just thank you for your time. Okay. To present this.
This was very comprehensive. I think there's a great deal of very valuable information here. I also think there's still some unanswered questions. Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Cummings, you and I talked a little bit about this yesterday. Shippers aren't always very forthcoming with information, and I know some of this is proprietary and held very close to the vest.
Yes.
So what they do today to make a decision to move cargo 3 months from now, if something changes, they're going to make a different decision.
You bet. That was one of the most challenging pieces.
It is. And I've been to national ag shippers conferences. I've met with folks who do this. They just want to get their product to market at the lowest cost, and they want to be efficient about it. Mm-hmm. So if something opens and they have an opportunity to take advantage, they will. The question is, as a public body, do you invest in something that has the challenge of not knowing what the outcome's going to be?
Yeah.
So do you build it and hope they'll come? Mm-hmm. Probably not a wise decision on the part of a public body. But I think you've done a wonderful job of creating a narrative with some really great basic information for all of us. So I appreciate your work. I know this was hard. There's a lot of slippery stuff here. And it's just the nature of what you're trying to quantify. But boy, we really appreciate Biz Oregon spearheading this. Thank you for your great work. And I don't know, Chris, do you have any wrap-up comments for us?
No wrap-up comments, but along those lines, if mm-hmm. I may, is that Sarah and Carl were, this was a quite short time frame mm-hmm. in this sort of study, and they did it admirably and got us what we needed in time for this session.
Great. And we appreciate you taking the lead on this as well. So thank you for your good work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I will close the information hearing and I think turn this to Mr. Brennan for a moment. We have a number of bills that we would like to introduce as committee bills. Committee, you have them in front of you. First of all, I want to be stated very clearly that introducing a bill does not obligate you in any way mm-hmm. to support or not support these concepts when they actually come.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure everybody understands these are concepts that we will be working on later. This doesn't obligate you to a vote. We have one bill I think that we will start on, and I'd like to see if... Show me that again, Patrick. Is Mr. Kozel here? Did I pronounce your name right, sir?
Yes.
Yes, please come up and join us at the dais if you'd like. Mr. Kozel has been working with his Representative Gilliam, on a bill that is something that he has identified as something he would like us to consider. And I thought first we would give you an opportunity to identify yourself and just tell us a little bit about this concept that Mr. Representative Gilliam has brought forward on your behalf.
Okay. I'm Jim Kozel from Mount Angel. Disclaimers. My employer, I'm a school bus driver. My employer, I'm not speaking for my employer, and my employer does know that I'm here. And I am not speaking for the school district that my employer contracts out.
Thank you for making that clear, sir. We appreciate that.
Okay. I've been a driver, school bus driver, for over 17 years. And the current, my current employment is about almost 9 years now, and I've been on the same school bus route for about 7 years and the same school K-8 school for about 9 years. And part of my route includes Highway 213, heavily traveled up towards Malala, between Silverton and Malala, and a lot of 55-mile-an-hour traffic. And there's a great concern of the safety of the students on the bus in that a lot of people shoot the red lights when I'm stopping or when I am stopped picking up or dropping off children. I drive about 85 miles a day. I transport about 120 students, all K-8 students, and a number of the stops are on Highway 213. The most recent shooting of the lights was this morning, about 10 of 8 on Highway 213. The one prior would have been about 4 o'clock in the afternoon last Friday. So, again, I see a lot of this. And I.
Sir, when you say shoot the lights, you mean you have your lights on and you are stopped and they are going around you. Is that what you're saying?
Well, coming towards me.
They're coming towards you and not stopping.
Right on by the lights.
Okay.
And in one section on Highway 213, I have 6 stops in about a mile, of which 3 of those are students that have to cross 213.
Okay. Thank
Others
you.
Load on the same side as I am on.
It's dangerous.
And so, but in any case, you're supposed to stop no matter which direction.
Right.
I'm concerned for the safety, and I'd like to see some sort of legislation, and I don't know what's out there right now, enacted where we could have photo radar on the buses. So that all we'd have to do is when we see a vehicle, when we're stopped and see a vehicle that's going to be shooting our red lights, mm-hmm. and we just push the button and it would take a picture of the vehicle and the license plate and so forth and be processed accordingly, and the people, the drivers, would be cited accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Also that if, for example, my employer were to put the photo radar in, there are some cost involved in that, but they would also share in the revenue from the tickets, and that would be either whether it's a private contractor or the school districts themselves that have their own school buses.
Well, I think you've raised a number of questions. Photo radar has been used in settings for quite some time, but this is a rather unique approach.
Yes.
And we are happy to introduce your bill, and it can go through a process just as all the rest of our bills do, and we'll look forward to having more conversation about it as the session unfolds after February 1st.
Okay.
But thank you for coming and introducing the concept, and we thank Representative Gilliam for drafting this bill on your behalf.
Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you. We'll have plenty of times for questions later.
Okay. Is it okay if I head back?
Yes.
Or do I...
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much, though. We appreciate you being here.
Okay.
That's very helpful. Mr. Brandon, would you like to just go through these concepts, and then I think what we'll do is introduce them all at once with just one motion,
sure.
if that's all right,
sure,
with the
Madam
panel?
Chair.
Everybody
for,
all right?
Just for clarification, the concept we just talked about was LC 2058. That was, as Mr. Kosol mentioned, Representative Gilliam asked the committee to introduce that concept on his behalf. Mm-hmm. The other ones we have before us are LC 936, which is from Representative Benz. It allows non-retail retail facilities located in low-population counties to permit self-service retail gas sale of class of flammable liquids, similar to what we did in 2015 session, but there are some differences, which we can go over at a later time, I think.
Perfect.
LC 1646 is from the Brownfields Coalition that establishes a task force on Brownfields tax credits. LC 2330 establishes a process for issuance of certificates of approval for operating autonomous vehicles. 2358 increases the allowable weight for vehicles equipped with functional idle reduction systems, and also for vehicles using natural gas as fuel source. That was a concept that we had during the 2016 session that was part of another bill. That bill did not move through mm-hmm. primarily and exclusively because of the other part of the bill besides this part. This is a non-controversial kind of bringing us in line with federal law. So that's a repeat bill from the 2016 session. LC 2444 allows ODOT to enter into agreements to allow a person to transact any function on the department on the department's behalf. It's referred to as vehicle integrators is what those folks are. So it's a bill dealing with vehicle integrators, which I believe we've had bills related to that before as well.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of expands the scope of the things that it would allow vehicle integrators to do under current law.
Is that a legal term that you're saying is in statute right now?
I'm not sure the term integrator is in statute, but that's kind of what they're colloquially referring to as. And then the last one, LC-2561, is a concept that was recommended by the Road User Fee Task Force and brought to the committee by Representative Lively, and it would eliminate the cap on the number of vehicles eligible to participate in the road usage charge program and direct ODOT to establish a method to register vehicles at point of sale. And it would, beginning with vehicle model years 2026 or later that have an EPA rating of 20 miles per gallon or better, would require such vehicles to be entered into the road usage charge program rather than allowing them to be. That would begin in the year 2026.
I will thank Representative Lively for bringing that bill.
Certainly.
All right. I'll turn to Representative Lively.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC-936, dated 7-18-2016. LC-1646, dated 11-29-2016. LC-2058, dated 11-30-2016. LC-2330, dated 11-7-2016. LC-2358, dated 11-3-2016. LC-2444, dated 11-3-2016, and LC-2561, dated 11-3-2016.
Representative Lively moves that the aforementioned list of LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Sure. Representative Bence.
Excused.
Representative Hack.
Yes, aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Excused.
Vice Chair Davis.
Excused.
Chair McHugh.
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you all. And we're finishing 7 minutes early, Representative Hack.
Thank you.
On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all. Representative Hack.
Thank you.